Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz here in the Kintec studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. Canucks Talk brought to you by The Hockey Shop in Langley. Shop in-store or online at thehockeyshop.com. And now joining us in studio, former NHL player, regular contributor here on 650 and on Sportsnet TV on the panels as well. He is our guy, Landon Ferraro. Landon, what's going on, man?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing?
You think we have enough to cover for an hour here? Enough going on with this team?
I think we can jam it in.
I think we'll be able to stretch it out and make it work. So, you know, I want to start with Saturday's game, but not necessarily the on-ice stuff, but your reaction as a former player to hearing a coach come out after the game and just straight up admit, say, we've got not one or two, three or four or five players that are having trouble getting emotionally invested. What was your reaction when you heard Rick Tocchet say that on Saturday?
I mean, it just felt necessary at that time.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing if you're in games but losing and it's just not quite, you know, working out in your favor, but it's another when it didn't really matter who you were playing against. They were going to lose in that fashion to anyone with mm-hmm. that type of effort. But the way that they came out, like, just so flat and not ready to kind of put their nose in where it needed to be. And that even the guys that were definitely on the better side of their performances, like, it still wasn't the same tenacity that they had shown literally two nights beforehand. So, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, the coach comes out and says that, then obviously Rutherford goes on after hours yep. and makes his statements. But the thing that I did like was none of it was emotional. Like, you could feel, obviously, Tocchet was
yep.
holding in a bit, but that's just, you know, he's a fiery guy, but understanding that, yes, this is not even close to, not even just good enough to win, but just close enough to being okay.
Yeah.
Like, as an organization for what they expect to go on the ice. But he still holds it together. Rutherford being the, you know, pretty blunt the way that he talks about things, but he's just very matter of fact, and there wasn't a panic in it. Just like, yeah, this wasn't great, but we already know that we have some things that we have to do. So on the player side, I feel that some of them would have been relieved that this was put out there. Mm. Other guys, knowing that they're probably ones that are being talked about in that group that he had mentioned, will be, at first I would imagine, a bit of embarrassment and anger, but at the same time, it's always in the back of your head of, like, as you're getting angry about it, like, but he's right.
Yeah.
And I know that he's right, and I need to figure that out. So it can be almost a relief to a team at a certain point. And then the other side of it too is just the guys hearing that and realizing, like, you know, you hear them talk about it all the time, like, this is our second family, and mm-hmm. and as corny as that is, like, it is true. You spend so much time together and go through so much that you hear some of those words and you're like, yeah, I know there's gonna be some change, but, like, we don't want it to be a blow up. Like, I don't want my buddies to be traded. Mm-hmm. I'm happy coming to the rink here. Like, that's something that can help galvanize a team as well.
Yeah, and I just find the wording so fascinating, right? Like, they're struggling to get emotionally invested, because it's one thing to be like, hey, they're not executing. Everyone understands there's going to be times where you're not at your best, right? You're not making the plays you want to play, or you're whatever. But it also feels like, and as you were kind of saying there, there's a baseline of professionalism that's expected when you're in the NHL, and it almost feels like it's getting to that. Like, that's what he's alluding to is, hey, you just, maybe you're not executing well, that's fine, but you have to at least care. Like, your give a blank meter has to be pretty high. And if that's an issue for some guys, like, I can understand why Taku would be extremely frustrated with that, because it feels like it should just be a baseline.
And it has to be. And to bring it up back a little bit, like, for borderline NHL guys. I was one of those where you're always fighting to, you know, either get called up or stay in the lineup or stay up on the big roster. Like, that's the biggest thing that separates those types of guys from sticking the NHL and not, is figuring out, how do I be relevant when I don't have it? And for good NHL teams, that's the difference between being okay in the league and being, you know, better and then exceptional in the league as well, of when our guys don't have it, what can we still bring to the team that we can be functioning at a level that we can still win games? Like, that's a true, real meaning of being a pro, is knowing what you can still bring if your legs aren't there, your hands aren't there. Like, you still have to contribute. And right now you have, you know, for the most part, a bunch of guys that it's either on or it's off, and there's really no in between. And that's a tough place to be.
How tough is it for the other players in the room? If they know, and I'm sure they do, right? If the coach is talking about it publicly, if they can see, okay, hey, these four or five guys, they're not in the fight with us right now, and it's going on for, let's say, a span of weeks or whatever. I mean, how tough is that for all the other guys in the room to look at that and know that they're not getting 100% effort right now?
It's tough. And it fully depends on each guy's situation. There's obviously a bunch of things behind the doors that we don't know are going on, and that doesn't mean bad things. It's just different relationships and how everything works. So when you have guys that, you know, aren't quite in the fight with you, it all kind of depends, again, like, on who that person is, to how you handle it. You'll have guys that'll, you know, call you out a little bit. It doesn't need to be in front of anyone else, but just having a little side conversation. But other guys, you might just need to go and have that conversation, but it'd be nothing about hockey. Like, just checking in and trying to see, like, you know, like, is there anything going on? Or if it's not, like, just, you know, what's going on in your head right now? Like, can we kind of figure this out a little bit? But there's so many different things that can play into that, but you have to find a way to, and this team has good leadership. Like, they'll find ways to, you know, kind of poke and prod different guys to get them to that level. And that's what being a good team is even if you're one of the best guys and it's not going your way, like, it might be one of the fourth line guys that can bring you out of your shell and what's going on. Like, it's just trying to get to that mix to, you know, have that support, really.
One thing that I noticed when I was working with NHL players, and this was 5 years ago, so I know a lot has changed even since then, but there was such a different ethos among the players who were closer to my age. So guys like you, who I worked with, whether it was like a Troy Brower or a Jamie McGinn, guys whose time in the NHL had sort of been punctuated or filled with, like, team events. You know what I mean? Like Sundays at the pub, just watching football or whatever, right? Get to a road city. Oftentimes guys are going out, and sort of the next generation of players where you'd got major money and major roles on your team from the age of 19, forget drinking beer. You don't eat gluten, right? Forget going out with the boys. You're going to stay at the hotel room and swipe left on your phone. And there was, I could see it from, I'm just saying.
No comment.
I could tell that it was just a very different, there was a generational divide that I could see coming from 5 years ago. And my guess is it's gotten even more extreme now. From your experiences as a player, how much did that impact relating to teammates? Did it change over the course of your pro career?
Oh, it changed for sure. I mean, like, when I first got into pro, it was 2011, 2012, I think it was. Like, us playing video games on the bus or traveling was our little PSPs.
Right.
And we were playing SOCOM for 12 hours.
And it was like jailbroken.
Yeah, but, like, you had everyone, but no one had headphones. Like, you're just playing. So as much as you were playing, like, you're still with the group.
Right.
And then over my last few years, especially before I went over to Europe, like, that turned into guys bringing their entire systems with those briefcases that have screens that pop up. And before you know it, like, there's half the team that is alone in their own rooms playing, because they're playing together.
Yeah.
But they're separated. And you're right. Like, the best part of being on a team and doing this, especially as you get older, because you realize how lucky you are. Like, you look at your buddies that have, you know, quote, real jobs, and you're like, man, it's a lot of work and a lot of time. Like, we get to hang out, and it's almost something that's expected, and it makes your team closer. Like, you get on the road and it's going to see different things, going to longer dinners, because mm-hmm. you don't have anything else you have to run to. Like, that's massive time to really get to know people, get to know, and as weird as this sounds, but like, get to know what guys don't like.
Right.
And start messing around. Like, that's where you start having some fun. Like, when you start traveling,
so you can
with
really annoy them.
For sure. Especially if you're in the American League, you're still on commercial flights. Yeah. Like, you're putting stuff in guys' bags. You're like, but you're filling time, and it's all working together, and it takes stress away from what your real life and work is. Yep. Of when things aren't going good, you can really kind of sink back into your group and know that you're supported.
Mm.
It's a massive thing, but the younger kids are built a little different, and, you know, not to get crazy into it, but like, with COVID happening and like everyone, like, you know, I see it with my younger brothers, like, they don't go out as much as they did, you know, as we did, because that's what their teenage years was sitting at home. So it's like, it's a really different thing, but you still need your older guys to make sure that people are getting together. There's always, you know, especially with holidays coming up, you make sure everyone has somewhere to go. Like, that's the best part of playing, is knowing that you have, you know, 20 to 24 other guys that really care about you and make sure that there's something that you're mm-hmm. involved in. And it's the only way to make it work.
With Tockett's commentary about emotional investment, right? The players were struggling to perhaps engage emotionally. Do you think we're seeing that? Like, when I think about why the floor has fallen out of this team, right? And it's not that they're not capable of putting in spectacular performances. They are. We've seen it a few times, like just over the last 5 weeks, a stretch of games that I mostly think have been concerning for this team. I look at the LA game, I look at the Ottawa game, I look at the Florida game and say, hey, look, like, they've got a pretty high level in them. It's just that when the floor falls out, it feels like they have a far lower baseline than we saw last season, even when things weren't necessarily going their way. And I think that comes down to a team that, to me anyway, looks a lot closer to average defensively than the elite group that they became over the balance of the season. Do you think there's an element to which the issues are work rate, emotional investment? Like, is it translating into what we're seeing on the ice?
Obviously been thinking about it a lot, just mm-hmm. like everyone has. And I think a big part of it is you've had so much noise around the team this year. And we, mm-hmm. It was basically this exact conversation last week. But like, a lot of
we would
noise
never repeat ourselves. How dare you?
But it goes right back to it of like, you have a bunch of guys out. So you have guys elevated in your roster all over the place. And they did a pretty good job at filling those holes and being able to jump up and provide more than that was, necessary for what would normally be. But now you have some guys that have come back into the roster, and usually it's like the one big guy comes back in and you see it for the first game of like, everyone's like, oh, thank God he's back, I can take a rest here. But for mm-hmm. them, it was Miller coming back, Demko coming back, like big pieces coming back. And I'm not saying the guys did it where they're like, okay, I can just leave it to them now. But I do think there's a bit of, I'm finally back to where I should be in the lineup and things should be moving a bit better. And it's not, okay, I can rest because they're back, but I think it's, I need a rest because I've just, like, when you get elevated in the lineup, it's hard on you. Like, you're constantly trying to make sure that you're doing better than you normally are.
Yeah.
Like, you're getting more opportunities. And when you miss a chance on the fourth line, it sucks because you don't get a ton.
Sure.
But you're not supposed to score every game. Like, but if you're now on the second line, that's mentally there of, I just missed that chance. Like, well, this is some of the minutes that we need to get goals from. So just mentally exhausted at certain points, I think, is a bit of an issue here.
One of the other things, and interesting, the mental exhaustion point, because one of the other things that Tockett talked about after the game on Saturday, and I don't know if I've ever heard it quite put like this by an NHL coach after a game, was basically said, like, look, we had a pretty good game plan and guys just didn't do it, didn't execute, whether it was, trying to exploit the weak side against the Bruins or plays they wanted to make in the offensive zone, whatever it was. He was pretty frank, just saying, yeah, we had a good game plan and they didn't do it, or at least they didn't start doing it till the third period. From a player's perspective, like, just talk us through kind of the process of, okay, you get the information, you get the pre-scout and the game plan from the coaches, and then why can it be difficult sometimes for the team to go out and execute that on the ice?
Well, when you're from the first, you know, basically from puck drop, like when you're trying to be perfect in your positioning and perfect on everything and it doesn't work instantly, you start, there's a, well, you don't normally, but in those types of games when it goes bad, like you start to overthink things and, okay, well, this isn't going to work, but if I get up into my right spot where I'm supposed to be and now they've gone D to D, I can read the next play and I'm now jumping in front of that, but they go up the middle. Like you're starting to go off and instead of just trusting what you've just seen on film and all that. But I mean, it might have been the first time that he is like point blank said it, but it's really no different than when he, you know, coaches slip in a, well, we had a couple guys on their own page tonight. Like, it's just a way nicer way. Like, this was a more blunt. You could tell he was trying to find the right words, and he just kind of settled on, I'm just going to calmly say this because I have nothing, no other way to go about it.
The Canucks are still, you know, what, 35 points in 29 games. They've done that in the absence of Demko for almost all of it, in the absence of Miller for a month. Philip Peronic's been out for 2 weeks now and has at least another 6 weeks sort of remaining on that timeline before he returns. They only got Dakota Joshua back a while ago. It still looks like he's finding his game. I mean, they've been through a lot and they're still on pace to flirt with 100 points at the very least. But when you think about how they've actually played, do you think this is a team that can compete with the likes of Vegas and Edmonton atop the Pacific Division?
I think you still have to make a move or two, and that's, you know, like Rutherford just said it, but at the same time, they've been saying it since minus one day of training camp started. Like, that was known coming in. They need, you know, they need a puck-moving defenseman that can play some minutes for sure. They need probably another winger. But at the same time, you have players that aren't playing to their ability right now, and that's not scoring, that's being hard to play against, making it a lot tougher on other teams. You know, like, not singling him out, but, you know, Joshua was a massive piece last year, and he's clearly trying to figure out his game still and definitely deserves that time.
Sure.
But because he will figure out his game and get back to moving and being that force that we all saw last year, like, that's basically like getting a like having a trade and bringing another piece in right now. Like, you have players that can do the things that they need done, but they just need to get to that level. I think, and that's why I think they still can be contenders and still are a very good team. Like, yes, you can say that the Florida game was a one-off of like perfection, but no, like that was everyone playing the way that they're designed to play, and they played it as a team, and it really worked. So if you can get, you know, with the pieces that you hopefully can bring in, and then everyone elevating their game, not to new levels, but to the same level of last year, like, that's a pretty good team. Like, it's pretty deep all of a sudden.
Yeah, and I guess the question for me is not so much can they compete if they get those pieces, right? Because I think that, yeah, for sure. And but it's also increasingly becoming like, is this team going to do enough to convince management to go out and add those pieces, right? Because I feel like if they continue to scuffle, and, you know, if you're sitting here, if we're sitting here in the middle of January and Rick Tocchet is still concerned about the emotional investment in some of the guys, I would think it would be very hard for management to justify going out and trading, you know, first round picks at the deadline if you think some of your best players aren't emotionally invested, right? Like, that's the big question for me is, are they going to kind of step up and with their own play demand that the management team adds to this group by looking like a contender at some point, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's, I don't think this is going to drag on till the new year and heavily into it, but of course, if this somehow kept moving this way and guys don't figure it out, which, again, I don't think is going to be the case. Like, I think this team, between its coaching staff and players and their leadership core, they should be fine. Like, they've been through enough as a group. They should be fine. But if it gets to that point, it's not, you're right, like, it's not, okay, what can we bring in? It's what can we set up for next year at this point, and not worry about, you know, can we stretch and maybe get to a second round if everything goes great. Like, you'll have to quickly, you know, switch to plan B of what you're going to do going towards the deadline. But I mean, again, it's, I think it's something where the guys, especially with the Christmas break coming up, and then you'll be moving, you know, as soon as you're back from break, then you're only a month and a bit from Four Nations.
From the big break, yeah.
And then there's a big reset there, and that's huge. Like, I didn't get to take those big breaks when I was playing because I was not at that level at that point yet when they were still sending guys over. But I remember hearing the older guys talking and saying, like, how big that was at different points of, like, yeah, we were in a tough stretch going in. Yep. And after, everyone just got to just get away, come back. We got to watch some fun hockey too, and like, it just got you excited to get moving again. Like, it's funny to hear that.
Get to
but
be
like,
a fan,
yeah.
Right?
Like, guys love, well, not all of them, but for the most part, like, guys love to watch. And then, you know, when it's best on best, like, there's a reason most of these guys are really good at hockey. Like, yeah, they had the skill set, but like, it's what they love more than anything. Like, they're watching that too.
Yep.
They want to see the best on best, and like, that's something again that can get them kind of moving a bit.
That's a 2-week break, by the way. Yeah, like, that's massive in the middle of the season for 2 weeks, like, off.
It was talking to Canucks players who were thrilled about the Four Nations and were like breaking down the rosters and stuff and just like immediately clicking in just how excited players were for the tournament, to, whether to watch as fans or participate, that made me get all in. You know what I mean? Like, it was the moment that I heard an NHL guy be like, "Don't sleep on Sweden," that I was like, "Oh yeah, let's go. I can't wait."
Of course, right? Like, and like, honestly, at the last Olympics, when we were sitting in Davos before we went over, you know, you're sitting around having some, you know, time getting to know each other, and you kind of start laughing at, like, what would have the roster looked like if us guys aren't here? And you start looking at, like, all right, on the fourth line right wing, who would have I been here? And, like, start looking, like, yeah, it's a little bit different. It's a little bit different here, but, well, we'll put the same jersey on. We got that.
That's fantastic. Yeah, it's 2 weeks in the middle of February, and then after you come back, you're like 2 weeks from the trade deadline. So it's you're right that like after Christmas, everything starts to really kind of accelerate and move quickly. And, you know, Jim Rutherford kind of said it himself on Saturday, right? Like, we're getting to the point now where, okay, we got 30 games, and yeah, there's been a lot of absences, but this is where you start to make decisions, big decisions about your team.
Back-to-back Januarys, right? The Canucks tried to re-sign Bo Horvat, did re-sign Kuzmenko. Couldn't get the Horvat deal done despite sort of a maybe half-hearted last-second effort, but nonetheless a last-second effort, and traded him in the month of January. Last January, of course, the Canucks start pushing to get Pettersson done and trade for Elias Lindholm in the month of January. So it's like January is a pretty big month for this organization historically. It's one where we should really start to pay attention to, especially coming out of their midseason meetings where they get a lot of stuff done. They seem to make some pretty key decisions on pending UFAs and on the trade market. And when you think about, you know, Besser, Lankin, and Pugh Suter, and then the needs of this team on the back end and up front, man, it's going to be an interesting next 6-7 weeks.
All right, we'll continue to chat with Landon. We'll look ahead to the game against the Avalanche tonight as well. Some of the other interesting things Tocchet had to say after the Boston game too. So lots more coming up here next on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We're live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? Canucks Talk brought to you by the Hockey Shop in Langley. It's a great day for hockey. And of course, 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Landon Ferraro joining us in studio for another segment here. And it is a game day. I feel like this is, in the history of Canucks Talk, this is the least so far that we've talked about the current, like the tonight's Canucks matchup in a show, because, man, there's been a lot going on. But it is a game day. They're taking on the Colorado Avalanche. So, you know, really nice rebound spot for the Canucks here after getting pummeled by the Bruins. Now you get to go up against Nathan MacKinnon and Mikko Rantanen and Cale Makar as well for good measure. So that'll be fun. That'll be nice.
But also the Avs bottom six.
I'm sure.
they're healthy again. It's not quite as dire as it was for a little bit there. If you watched them in early November, though, it was like, yes. I don't know if they're a playoff team.
Yeah.
I had a moment. I entertained that they might not be a playoff team in November.
Guy like McKinnon, I understand there's not many of him in the league. It's a, you know, even historically kind of rare. But that, the speed, power, skill combination. Like, how do you even begin to prepare and kind of mentally prepare for being up against that if you're the Canucks going into tonight?
Well, the thing with him, too, is like all the things you just said, but there's lots, not lots, but there's guys in the league that can skate fast,
yes,
and can do everything, but he does everything so aggressive.
Yes.
That,
including skating.
In skating, his stick handling, like everything that he does is aggressive and hard, and it looks, like, honestly, it looks choppy at points,
mm-hmm,
but he's so powerful. Like, he takes those crossovers as he starts getting up to his blue line when he picks up the puck, as he's going through the neutral zone. Like, there's not many guys that you look up and you're like, I don't want to deal with that. Like, there's most where you're like, oh, I can start my angle and we can make this work and I'll cut off some time. Like, for him, he will make his move, but then go through you if he has to.
I think him and McDavid are the only two guys in the league where you can be, think you're hooped when they have the puck in their own zone. You know what I mean? And you can already tell, you're like, uh-oh, this isn't going in a good direction because he's got so much speed already.
The one thing, though, the one distinction stylistically to watch them, right, is McDavid moves like you're in slow motion,
mm-hmm,
right? Like, he just floats by you and it seems silly. McKinnon, the phrase they use in football for running backs is he runs angry.
Mm-hmm.
McKinnon's the only guy in the league I've ever seen who I'm like, he skates angry.
Yes.
That's perfect, too. Yeah. Like, you're right. Like, McDavid, you know, when they do the, you know, Bouchard has it, he kind of gains their blue line and then drops it back. And you're right. Like, before he even touches that puck, you can see the defenseman already pivoting feet and like, mm-hmm, okay, I need to get moving already. You're a zone and a half away from him. But when McDavid picks it up, he does those tight crossovers and they're light.
Right.
But he's just like propelling himself up the ice. And with McKinnon, it's like that first stride, as soon as he touches the puck, it's like he cuts his foot right down to the cement.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everything is so powerful that you're like, you're going to run out of space eventually. And it's funny because you've seen it with guys where the D will read it right, but he's got his feet kind of planted.
Mm.
And McKinnon literally just puts his shoulder through that person because he's like, oh, I didn't realize he was going to cut me off. Well, I'll just go through him. And there's not many guys that can hold on to, yeah, a puck after taking that.
So the Canucks are among the many teams in the league that, pivoting off of something the Oilers did so successfully in the playoffs last year, tried to install more of that like anchoring play along the offensive blue line where you've got the forward cutting across the landmarks that Rick Tocchet was talking about. You know, you get it, and then it's almost like a 5-on-5 drop, right? You find a way to get it to a guy who's moving downhill, and when the Oilers do it, and they do it better than anyone else in the league and hit McDavid in stride, it's unfair. Like, it honestly, I don't know how you solve it as a defender, but I think it's, you know, one of the many factors that have combined to have shooters winning the war against goaltenders after a generation of losing it in a lopsided fashion. But with Colorado, I don't want to say it because it sounds dismissive, but there's a certain sense to which when they're attacking and playing well, they almost attack like a roller hockey team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're going to see that, especially with their defense tonight, where you've got like Malinsky who can fly. Gerard, Taves, Makar, you know, there's not a lot of size there. Like, it's almost a tremendous styles make fights contrast between Vancouver's trees on the back end and what Colorado is going to be rolling out, which is just like six guys that can skate really fast.
Yeah, but the hard thing there is, can you, on the offensive side, when you're in the O-zone, can you cut those guys' skates off? Can you make the night harder for them that you have a smaller guy like Gerard having to defend in his own end and play on the boards? Like, anytime that you get stuck on the boards for more than, call it 3 or 4 seconds, like, you're wasting a ton of energy that, it's just like, it's hard to fight through. And while you're still trying to find the puck, if they're allowed to freewheel, they're at the advantage all night because a skater's going to take the big guy more times than not, right? Like, it's just, it is what it is. But if you can slow them down, then you allow your big guys to really lock everything down and it kind of flips back the other way. But I think tonight, like tonight, will all rest on can the Canucks get in and forecheck? Like you were talking about the landmarks and stuff, and that was one of the biggest differences, I think, as well, of Florida to last game was right. Every time that they threw that puck up to the guy at the far blue line stretching, they did have someone coming underneath so they could give it to him, or if they did tip it in, there's already someone on the forecheck. Mm-hmm. Last game was, it was almost like a practice in a sense of like, you tell the guys, okay, break out and then dump it in at the far end and just let them break it out.
Right.
Like, just put token pressure in. And but like, that's kind of what it was for a lot of the night, was token pressure. And it's just, it makes it so much more evident than when it's literally like 48 hours earlier yeah. that was the exact opposite.
You've hit on something that we've been talking about on this program since its inception, right? Which was that the fundamental dynamic that this team has dealt with the last three or four seasons has been that when their forecheck plays, they can win. But if they tend to rely, or if they have to rely, because the other team's breaking out clean, on advancing the puck from the back end out, that's where this team can get a little bit stuck in the mud. I mean, is that... are we still in that sort of state where until this team gets a more dynamic puck mover to help them solve the both defend and attack at the same time question, effectively we're just seeing like an elevated version of a team that's still dealing with the same issues that they have for the last 3-4 years?
I would say to a certain extent, yes. Mm-hmm. I would say that as much as, yes, like you need the defense to be able to make a play coming out of your own end, like you can't, the forwards can't have to be trying to fight for a puck back, like a 50-50 puck every time it ends and or leaves your end. Like, again, that's just, it's a lot more wasted energy that if you just can make the first play and now you're skating up the ice, like you'll have that extra 10 seconds of a shift that you're actually putting it to use instead of, you know, playing whack around in the neutral zone between the two teams. But I think that, again, like this is a team, you know, Talk had said it, I think it was yesterday, but, you know, like Edmonton can have a bunch of guys that aren't playing well and they can still figure it out. Like, but it's the same thing for on the defensive side of the puck. Like the forwards need to, if you notice that, okay, that was an issue last game, well, instead of, you know, you always have the one guy blowing the zone because you're pushing the other D back. Like, you need that guy cutting across. But if I'm the near winger and the center, maybe I'll, instead of coming back two steps, I'll come back three. Like, just make everything a little bit shorter, a little bit easier, and then start connecting that way. Like, just to the point of not giving the D another option other than you have to give it to me or you're going to have to put it by my ear to get it off the glass, to get it out. Right? Like, just try and support that way.
Yeah. And one thing I'm really fascinated to watch tonight, you know, speaking about you can't be fighting 50-50 every time the puck leaves your zone and all of that in Colorado's speed is, you know, another of the things that Talkett had to say after the Boston game was, you know, frustration with guys not making plays, right? Hey, we're dumping the puck out. We're icing the puck. Instead of making a pass in our own zone, it's just off the glass and out. You know, sometimes if you skate another 5 feet, then there's a little 10 or 15 foot pass that's available to you. So you got to think that's going to be a point of emphasis coming into this one. But it's also interesting because it's against one of the fastest teams in the league. As Drance was saying, you look at the defense corps, all guys that can skate, McKinnon, Rantanen. There's so many guys that can burn you. So it's going to be an interesting position, right? Because you want to see them be a bit more aggressive, be more willing to try to make those plays. But the risk, if it goes poorly, is pretty significant against this team as well.
But I'd almost make the argument of, like, yes, it's harder because the pressure's there, but because they skate so well, they'll commit more to the forecheck. And if you can get it past that first guy, well, now you've already beat one. Can you make the second pass? Now you got two forwards caught.
It feels like this is also the type of team you really need to be able to do it against, right? You can't just be giving them the puck back and dumping it in because if they're, you know, if Cale Makar gets the puck, guess what? He's going to be up and it's going to be back in your end really quick, right? So it's risky, but it's also so important to be able to control it a little bit more coming out of your own zone against this Colorado team.
Cale Makar is the sickest shot maker from the back end I've ever seen.
Yeah, he's pretty good back there. he seems to find a way, I don't know how, but he seems to find a way to get himself on the score sheet quite a bit. And
he scores goals that look like fadeaway jumpers sometimes. And like, just like the shots that he makes aren't just incredible. but they're like, I've never seen a shot maker like him play defense in the NHL.
I think it's just the hockey IQ of understanding lanes, understanding the defensive side of the puck so well that he knows that, you know, if I can make this move and open up the first forechecker, well, the second, that net front D is going to take his step out, but he can't get to the far side. Like, he just understands where that lane will be. Mm-hmm. And you're right, like, but that's, you know, something that coaches say all the time for D shots is, like, it doesn't need to be a 100-mile-an-hour slapper. Like, an 85-mile-an-hour kind of little quick wrister is generally better. Like, it gets through a bit easier because it's more precise. But not only that, being the net front guy, like, on the being the forward, like, now it's easier to get a stick on it. When the rebounds hit, like, say it hits the left arm, if it's a hard shot, that goes into the corner. If it's a bit softer, it drops down. Now you have another look at it. Like, there's a lot that goes into it other than just he's really good at walking the top of the line.
It's been fascinating to watch this because the slap shot going a little bit the way of the dodo bird. First, it came for forwards, but now you're seeing it with D, where, like, Quinn Hughes is one of the sort of ground zero players for this, where he stopped taking slap shots, right? Yeah. Like, he specifically started
one-timer or not.
Yeah, like, right. He now is attacking downhill, right? He's relying on that wrist shot. And Zane Parekh, the Flames prospect, when I was watching him in Penticton, and then again in the preseason, is maybe the most extreme example. Like, I don't think he's ever thought about taking a slap shot once. Like, he is 100% always looking to get that wrister off. It's seeing it from a younger player, like a guy who has zero pro reps yet to this point in his career, was what really convinced me that, like, we are in a new era now. Younger defenders are thinking this differently.
But the cool part of that, too, is, like, the evolution of it is, like, you watch, you know, a guy in the 90s or even 2000s walking the line, like, it's a lot of pushing the puck.
Right.
And now, like, the guy's hands are better than the majority of forwards now. Like,
right.
It's crazy. But, like, they don't want their stick away from the puck. Like, their hands are so fast that as soon as that, you know, like, if I'm going out to, you know, forecheck on that D playing on the blue line there, like, if he brings his stick all the way up, it makes my job pretty easy. Like, the most that he can do is smack it back, right? Like, I can get out to it. I know he can't go anywhere. Like, he's not connected to it. But now, like, the guys, the puck are on their tape the entire time because as soon as they see that lane or they see an opening, like, they get to it instantly. It's not, there's not that time lapse or, you know, a little lag between it now.
Right. With, yeah, and so then we get to this point where we see guys like Bouchard operating on the Oilers' power play, and the slap shot feels like it catches people off balance. It's like, we don't see it that often, right? Like, he's like the guy who does it, you know?
But yeah, who else has the big slapper from the point in the league now? I can't, like...
There's a few guys, but I can't...
But, like, he's the signature
him,
one.
Him, Ekblad.
Whereas it used to be, you know, like, McInnes, and you go, like, there were so many guys.
Weber.
Shea Weber, right?
I mean, even guys like Alex Edler were taking high-volume slap shots.
But again, like, I think the bit of a difference there is, one, they don't have the time that they had. Like, everyone is so much more aggressive in their D-zone coverage. Like, they're not everyone's just sinking to the middle and just kind of standing there. But you have guys that, well, in Bouchard's case, like, he gets to take that one-timer because everyone is so concerned about the two other players on his flanks. Like, McDavid and Dreisaitl, like, you have to pay so much extra attention to them that you end up having to dive down at, if it's McDavid rolling off that right flank, like, you dive down at him so much harder than any other player. While that opens up Bouchard, he has the time to take it. Like, most other D, they don't have the time because players aren't as worried about the other guys.
A couple of other, you know, lineup tweaks for the Canucks going into this one. One of them is Max Sasson getting a chance to move up and at least start the game in the top six on the wing with Elias Pettersson and Jake DeBrusk. And, you know, he scores his first goal, the bright spot in that game against the Bruins on Saturday. Picked up a couple of nice primary assists against the Panthers the game before that. And it does feel like the Canucks have kind of been waiting for one of these young players coming up from Abbotsford to really step up and demand a bigger role or a more permanent role. And, you know, we'll see if he's ultimately able to do that. But what has allowed, in your eyes, Max Sasson to have this little bit of success and earn himself the top six opportunity?
the fact that he's been able to play the exact same game he does in the American League gives him a bit of a head start on the other guys that have been called up. You know, Lekkerimäki's young and figuring out his first full year over here. And yeah, when he came up, he's still playing in the same role technically, yep. But you go watch him in Abbotsford, he has the puck on his tape the entire time he's on the ice. And that's just not the case up here. So he's not able to do that yet. You know, Baines has done a good job while he's been up, but at the same time, like, again, he's looking to be a scorer. Like, he's looking mm-hmm. at, you know, having more of that offensive style. And, you know, Sasson's had 5 points in 10 games, but at the same time, those come because he's playing a very honest, hardworking game. And when you have a line that has been a little quiet the last two games, haven't really drive the play much, putting a simple forward with them, I like it, because it's as soon as it gets to Sasson's side, like, they know he's not going to be trying anything crazy. Like, just go straight up yep. the ice. And that is something that, again, like, I feel like I say it all the time, because but I just think it's true. Like, the more simple game that you can play, even if you're the most skilled guy in the world, like, yeah, you can complete the play different, but the simple play is still the best play. Mm-hmm. So just go back to basics. And with Sasson, just the fact that he has that, you know, he's not a 19-year-old kid, but he's young and he's got the excitement in him still. He hasn't been through all of this. He's not having to take on everything that has been put out there this year. Like, he's a light player.
He hasn't had the joy
seriously
snuffed out
though.
Of him yet.
but it's something as little as that. Like, if a play goes wrong tonight and Pettersson and DeBrusk are, you know, pissed on the bench about it, and they look over and they see the young kid that's kind of just playing because he's excited in his chance, and like, yeah, that's fine, we'll go get the next one. Like, I'm just happy I'm getting the opportunity. Like, you bring a little of that onto your next shift. Like, you see the excitement, you're like, all right, yeah, we're fine. Like, let's just go make the next play.
At practice yesterday, he was skating on the line with Elias Pettersson. When you're a player like Sasson, 10 games into your career, you've had some offensive success, but most of it's come against the grain, although he does finish that Miller chance on Saturday night. What sort of key to succeeding in a pretty significant audition should they in fact start the game with him beside Pettersson tonight?
Talk had touched on it this morning in his little talk after pregame of holding on to pucks, and then Sasson said the same thing in his little media availability as well. And I would say the biggest issue of players with their first time getting called up, or even, you know, just in the first couple, is you're so scared to turn a puck over that you dump every puck that comes near you.
Yeah.
And yeah, you get through the night and you have zeros across the board and you're like, okay, like, I didn't get scored on. Like, I feel decent about that. But you also didn't bring anything to the team. Like, you have to be able to hold on to pucks. You have to be able to not even make plays as in, like, setting up a goal constantly. But just, the D gives you the puck on the half wall in your own end. Can you make a tape-to-tape play out of your end and not have to make Pettersson go chase it down up the wall? If that needs to happen, that's fine. But, like, just having the confidence to play and not get overwhelmed and not try to do too much. And that's something that he seems to understand.
Well, and that holding onto the puck, I mean, that's not just a struggle for young players. I mean, that's what it's talking about the whole team right now, right? Is, hey, they need to hold onto the puck a little bit more. And that's what impressed me so much about the first assist that Max Sasson got in the Florida game, right? He picks up the puck in the neutral zone and he has multiple chances to just make the really safe play. Dump it in, right? Yeah. Dump it in. Okay, hey, we're the fourth line. I've got Blueger and Heinen with me. Let's go forecheck. Gains the zone instead, holds on a little bit, and a play opens up where he's able to pass it to Soucy. So I think that really stood out. And you're right, like, how hard it can be mentally for a young player like that to kind of get in that mindset.
Yeah, and I, like, his two assists the two nights ago, I think are, like, I feel like I've heard them be kind of dumbed down a bit, of kind of taking away credit to him. Mm-hmm. Like, the first one, you got to give Bluger a ton of credit because he's the one that blows through left to right going through, and he pulls that back checker with him, and that opens up the lane for Sasson to cut to the middle. But on Heinen's goal, like, that's not a play where he's just throwing it to the net and like, oh God, I hope something goes that way. Like, he puts it at a perfect spot to where Heinen either gets his stick on it and there's a chance off that, or it hits the pad and the puck stays in front. Like, that's not a just a, oh, please end my shift, cover it, and then we have an ozone drive, done great. Like, he's trying to put the puck into a spot that not only one, but maybe multiple guys have a chance at. Like, that's high IQ. And you have to be able to hit those spots and not get too excited in the moment. Like, it's easy to miss far side an extra foot high on that shot because you're like, I want to get it in there so bad that you end up just kind of putting way too much on it. And like, him to have the presence of mind to be okay in that situation, like, I think that shows that he's not overwhelmed in the league yet. He's not been in a situation where he doesn't believe that he can play his game, and that's a great spot to be.
But just before we wrap up here, one of the other things that Rick Tocchet had to say over the weekend, talking about on the power play, you know, the first unit can get too individual a little bit when they're down or when things aren't going their way. Does that match what you're seeing, and how do you get out of that mindset of being too individual on the power play?
I think you get back to what they had been doing pretty good at different points through the year of just being a shooting power play, not looking like, I would say for them, I don't think it gets, maybe on the break-ins it gets a little individual when they can't, when they keep getting stuck, but in zone I feel like when it's not going well, it always turns back to, we are going to run like basketball plays where like, you are literally in your spots everywhere you need to be. And it doesn't matter what's happening. We need to get to that. Like, I think that's more the issue. And when they're going, they get pucks to the net. Quinn Hughes is, I mean, he's obviously unreal at getting pucks through, but he also recognizes, and Tocchet had talked about this as well, of like, there's a two-on-one at the net, like, just get it in there and let them battle that out. Like, put your guys in good spots. Be more aggressive. Don't let the PK set up. Anytime that the PK gets to literally stand still for even just a couple seconds, like, as a PK guy, like, you get to take a full deep breath. You get to look around and you're like, oh, okay, like, we're fine, like, we're okay. Like, that's what you have to make sure that doesn't, you don't allow them, like, just get the puck to the net, get them moving, don't let them take a break.
Yeah, the individual thing was interesting for me. I think you make a good point about the breakouts versus in zone, because sometimes in zone I almost feel like we could use a little more, like, hey, you're being aggressive and looking for a shot. You know what I mean? Yeah. Sometimes it seems like it's almost too tentative in zone, more than going out of the structure trying to make a play.
And I would almost say, it just popped in my head, but I would almost say in zone on the power play, when it's, like I was saying, like, yeah, it gets to those more set plays, but I would say it's individual. It's like being forced to be an individual where there's no support on loose pucks. Yeah. Like, you're so committed to, well, I'm the guy that's going to get it when we rim it out after we win the puck. Well, you got to win the puck first. So it's guys not going in and helping. So it's almost forcing guys to have to make individual efforts.
Landon, this was awesome, man. Thank you for coming in and spending some time with us again. It's always a pleasure. And I think this is probably our last time before the holidays. So have a great holiday season. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays, man. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks. You guys as well. Hope Santa's good to you.
Yes, me too.
It never has been before.
Well, that might be saying something about you.
Grant's got his whole collection of lumps of coal at home every year.
Hey, I'm a big barbecue guy. I prefer that form of fuel, so. I think Santa just wants me to cook meat.
Oh, man. All right, we'll take a break. Last segment coming up here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. We're live from the Kintec studio. Canucks Talk is brought to you by the Hockey Shop in Langley. Shop in-store or online at thehockeyshop.com. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. We will hear from Rick Tocchet momentarily. Before we do that, I do want to add some context, some information, some reporting to the Buffalo Sabres-centric Elias Pettersson trade speculation kickstarted, let's say, by Elliot Friedman on 32 Thoughts today. Frank Saravalli from the Daily Faceoff, also a contributor here on Sportsnet 650, tweeting earlier today, sources indicate Sabres players met with owner Terry Pegula and GM Kevin Adams today in Montreal. Summary of message: we believe in you. The solution is within this room. The owner professed faith in Adams, Lindy Ruff, and apparently told players not to expect a big trade. So, throwing a little cold water maybe on the idea of Buffalo shipping Bowen Byram or Dylan Cousins out.
Well, look.
Breaking news, the Vancouver Canucks have traded. Oh, no, I'm kidding. Could you imagine?
Yes. Making a wild trade? Yeah, I sure can.
After a notice, is not to expect one.
Boy, can I. So the holiday roster freeze is like right around the corner.
Yes, Friday. The 19th. Yeah. Like Thursday. Or is it like Thursday at midnight?
Thursday at midnight. Yeah. So we are, you know, it's... You're getting pretty late in the game.
To execute like a blockbuster mega deal, unless you've been talking for a significant period already.
Which they reportedly were.
Well, talking, but that's different than like hammering out a deal. You know what I mean? There's stages of this.
Yeah, and when you look at
Some might say tears.
No, not tears. What do you think tears are?
They're rolling down my face when I'm laughing.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be pretty difficult to execute a significant trade, especially a trade of the sort of significance that we're talking about when we're talking about Pettersson and Cousins and, you know, players of this stature and with this level of salary committed, you know, at the 11th hour before the holiday freeze kicks in.
Yeah.
I think not that I never bet against Alvin and Rutherford finding a way.
Making something happen, yeah.
But... feels hard to do a really big deal this week.
You would think so.
Also, don't you want to see how this week plays out? Don't you want to see how this group reacts this week? Like, this is the first time in a long time that the Canucks have played regular season games that seem fraught.
Mm.
You know, like, this team's position could be very different a week from now, either positive or negative. And don't you want to see what this group is able to dig in and do in terms of getting there? And look, like, you know, Quinn Hughes talked to the media today, but he's been playing with a face shield. I'm sure it's been deeply uncomfortable. We've seen him on camera, you know, raise his fist when cameras are close by during the anthems and stuff. Like, he's been playing through some stuff. Pettersson's skating speed is way down in next-gen stats. JT Miller has scored twice in 12 games since October 25th. And both of those were empty netters. So JT Miller hasn't beaten a goalie since October 25th. I know he missed a lot of time, but it's a pretty hefty length of time since he's had that rush. You know, like just that rush of scoring. Thatcher Demko looks like he's going to start his second consecutive game. Hasn't exactly been a warm return.
Nope.
Right? Not that I think he's played poorly. I want to be very clear about that. I think he's been hung out to dry in both of the games that he's played. I've actually been pretty astonished by Vancouver's defensive efforts in front of him, but he's made, he's been beaten 9 times on 53 shots against. That's not Demko. That's not vintage Demko. Not that we would have expected vintage Demko right from the get-go. There's a lot of things. Like, this is a team that collectively, right? It's not one guy in some ways. You know, everyone kind of needs to pull up their bootstraps and make sure that this week doesn't snowball.
Yeah, that's absolutely it does. By the way, I do like this text from Mike, the urologist from Brockville, on the message from Sabres ownership to the players. He says, the solution is in this room as trade bait. The solution is in this room, in the sense that we're going to trade somebody in this room for players who will make our team better.
Wow. The, like, super literalist.
Well, I would love for him to come out, like, for them to make a massive trade, and then Pegula to be like, yeah, the solution was in the room, because we traded him for a good player. There we go. I was honest the whole time.
The Buffalo thing is sad, because when you look at the Eastern Conference, the Rangers and the Boston Bruins feel like the sick old men of the Eastern Conference this year.
Yeah.
Like, there is absolutely an opportunity, and there's so many of these Stryver-class teams that have been building for a few years to get to the point where they should be able to knock out one of these vulnerable-seeming, older, more well-established Eastern Conference teams. And this is the year that those teams are really showing signs of slippage.
Yeah.
I mean, the Bruins have like a minus 20 goal differential, and that's after lighting up the Vancouver Canucks.
Yep.
You know, the New York Rangers, I don't know if you saw what they made the LA Kings look like the other day, but they made them look like...
No, they're a point above NHL 500.
They made them look like the tiki-taka Barcelona team from 15, 20 years ago, like the Pep Guardiola, Ola, yeah. like prime Messi, like that Adrian Kempe goal. Did you see it?
Yeah.
Like, what are we talking about?
Yeah.
And that's the LA Kings. That's the, like, defensively stout LA Kings who we don't know if they have enough venom in their offensive attack.
We don't know if they're an elite offensive team. Yeah.
And then they pull off a play like that against the Rangers. Like, come on, man. That is not acceptable.
No, the Rangers are in trouble.
Rangers are in trouble. Boston's in trouble. And yet, Buffalo's not poised to step through that door. Detroit is not poised to step through that door. In fact, the only team that might be...
Ottawa.
...is the Ottawa Senators, who come into town shortly after the Canucks get back. I mean, the Canucks' next game back after they face Utah and Vegas back-to-back this week is against Travis Green and the Ottawa Senators on Saturday night.
Although, you know what's wild? You know what team is basically tied with
Minnesota?
The Rangers for points percentage?
Yes.
Very good.
Thank you.
The Flyers.
I know.
Are essentially tied.
But look, the Flyers.
I'm not saying, they're going to make the playoffs or anything. I'm just saying that's how far the Rangers have fallen in a relatively short period of time.
For sure. I mean, but the Flyers and the Senators are both positioned to maybe take a run. It's just that we know that the Flyers are going to run out of gas in the last 6 weeks of the season. Like,
yeah.
We know this, so I'm not taking them very seriously. The Ottawa Senators are a team that actually, like, the Senators and the Senators are the Eastern Conference version of Utah.
Mm.
They're the teams that I'm leaving the light on for, because their 5-on-5 game is good enough. There's a lot of young talent. You know what I mean? Like, it wouldn't be a shock for them to be far better in the second half of the season than they were in the first half of the season, given the youth on the roster and the profiles of those teams. So, you know, and in Ottawa's case, Linus Ullmark has figured his game out. Like, he's now a reason for them winning games, which wasn't true earlier in the year. So, yeah, I'm curious to see if either a team can actually get it together for long enough to challenge for a playoff spot and sort of upset the established pecking order in both the East and the West.
Just before we hear from Rick Tocchet on tonight's game against the Avalanche, 7:30 start time, by the way, for this one, I wanted to read this text that came in the first segment when we were talking about, you know, players struggling to get emotionally invested. And it's from Amrit, and it says, if Tocchet can't get the players motivated, then it's on him. He's an average coach. There wasn't a rush of teams wanting to hire him when he became available. He was employed at TNT when coaching opportunities came up. He was average at his previous two stints, and he is average right now. And his boring style is a reason attendance is declining. Now, Amrit doesn't say they should fire Rick Tocchet. You have started to see that sentiment crop up on social media, sometimes in our inbox as well. I think it's still very much a small minority of Canucks fans who are starting to pin this on Tocchet. And look, Rick Tocchet's not a perfect coach. Of course he's not. There are no perfect coaches. He's not blameless. He can always do things differently, as he would tell you himself. But the idea of looking at everything that's going wrong for the Canucks, or seems to be going wrong, and, you know, playing these fraught regular season games against, you know, at least one team that could push them out of a playoff spot too, actually, the Avalanche as well. The idea of looking at all of this and concluding that it is primarily the coach's fault and replacing the coach is the path forward, is the best solution, that is baffling. Baffling to me. Rick Tocchet just won the Jack Adams. And not only did he win the Jack Adams, but the way he turned this team's defensive game around last year was absolutely incredible. Phenomenal. There's no way you can look at the job he did last year and not say it was an extremely, extremely impressive coaching performance by Rick Tocchet. It's just impossible. Yeah, we can talk about PDO and all that and regression, but still, the work he did changing the defensive game for the Canucks was off the charts. So that doesn't mean, again, that he's exempt from criticism, but there are no grounds for fair criticism of Rick Tocchet. But I just, and look, even before we start to get into, you know, tactical decisions and his system and what he could be doing differently, if you're out there campaigning for Rick Tocchet to get fired, let's say hypothetically the Canucks did that. That would mean you're hiring a fourth coach in four seasons for this core group of players, right? It would be Travis Green, Bruce Boudreau, Rick Tocchet, new guy X, coaching Elias Pettersson, JT Miller, Quinn Hughes, Thatcher Demko, Brock Besser.
New guy X is already being criticized for too much dump and chase.
What has this core done to deserve a fourth coach in 4 years? Like, if you're talking about, if you're talking about major changes, it has to start with major personnel changes. You cannot just keep cycling through coaches every 18 months and expect that to fix the problem long term. Like, what else could you expect from Rick Tocchet than what he's already done with this group? So that doesn't make any sense whatsoever for me right now. All right, on that note, let's hear from Canucks head coach Rick Tocchet.
Yeah, another tough game, another good challenge. It's things that you know, we're looking forward to doing, you know, these type of challenges in an 82 game schedule.
Demering goal.
Yeah, Lance was. I think he was on the ice today, but he wasn't feeling that great. So, like I said, there's some flu that's going around.
So already rolled back up still.
Yep. Yep.
What do you do on defense? Your third pair tonight.
Yeah, I think we're going to Vinny will go in for a Freet. Forbes not ready to play yet.
Rick said against the Lightning, I think it was like their best players won the game. Something tonight, play against a team with a lot of star power. How do you control that?
Well, you got to take the neutral zone. You can't let them freewheel, right? And like I said, you know, I thought, and for the, you know, it's just no different than playing Barkov and those guys. You know, the other night when we shut them down half decently, you got to go through people. You got to be above. Things are the same thing. It's a you play great players. You got to make sure you pay attention to the details.
MacKinnon has a pointless night, and two nights later goes in the pit and puts up 5 points.
Yeah.
What makes him special, Rick, in the sense that he's kind of an old school guy, old school player?
He just moves. He moves his feet. Like when he gets the puck, he's moving. And when you move, when you have the puck and you move, options open. You know, very rarely I see him coast. You know, he coasts when there's awareness, but most of the time when he gets the puck, like all great players, they're moving their feet, and then all of a sudden there's three options instead of one. So I just marvel. And plus his, you know, out of the corners, you know, his strength, you know, he's one of the best guys in the league at it.
You've tried all kinds of messaging with your team here, especially over the last couple of weeks. It's gotten to the point now where let's just play the game as opposed to all the messaging that you have to do as a head coach and try to get the best of your players.
Yeah, as an individual, you got to sharpen your game up, but, you know, we're still, I don't know, we're 5-3-2 last. It's not horrible. We need some guys to play, you know, more consistently. There's no secret to it. You know, you got to play consistently.
How do you achieve that consistency, Rick? How do you get people to understand and become more consistent?
Well, it's the way you practice. It's the way you come focus in meetings. You just got to continue to, you know, you have to be focused. You know, how do you get a guy to be focused? Continue to teach him. Continue to tell him what's at stake. Ice time. I mean, there's a lot of the things, whether you play or not. I mean, there's a focus level they have to have consistently. That's what good teams do.
What role does your leadership group play in getting that intensity up?
Oh, it's a major role. You know, we haven't had our leadership group together, you know, all this year. You know, Demmer's been out, Millsy's been out, Huggy's been around. You know, so, you know, they haven't been around. So collectively, when they're around more, that does help the dressing room.
Rick, when you look at this team and you talk about needing everybody on board,
yeah,
it's not like those four or five players are just going through the motions or just, you know, collecting a paycheck, but is it more so that they need to find that extra gear, that extra 5% that pays huge dividends in their game?
Yeah, in a game, like, most of the time the game is played pretty even, I think, 70-80% of the time. It's at 20%, there's moments where you need a guy to make a play, and it could be any kind of play. Whether it's a block shot, that's your guy. Make sure that you stay with your guy. I just think when inconsistency comes, is you lose focus for you can lose focus for 5 minutes and you miss a guy twice and it's in your net. That's the moments that we need more consistent from a lot of guys. Stay in the moment and make those plays when they need to be made. You have a 3-on-1, a chance to go on a 3-on-1. Like, take that moment and go do something about it. You know what I mean? I'm just using that as an example. That's how you get consistent.
But you talk about that. That's habits, right? That's whether you're focusing in on a meeting or focusing in on practice. You've got to keep developing those habits, right?
Yeah, habits, accountability to yourself, yeah, to your teammates.
How do you get away from the egregious stuff? I mean, like a veteran player is under pressure and suddenly he's icing the puck because he's under pressure rather than maybe a soft.
Just reps, continue pressure. It's the same thing last year. We talked about me pressure with pressure. Like, you got to put yourself in these situations. Like, we have a young kid like Sass, he played 6 or 7, but he's playing in these kind of these pressure moments. Now he's holding on to a puck. Maybe 5 games ago when he first got up, he would just throw it away. But now he's kind of played a few games. Now, hey, man, I can do this. It's no different than any other player. You got to be put in these pressure situations all the time. That's why, the teams that are constantly in the playoffs play these pressure games. They don't panic, and I think that's something that we just got to continue to work at as a team.
Is your thinking tomorrow with this flu bug going around that maybe it's better just to get to the next place rather than practice?
That's why you didn't practice the other day. You try to separate, certain guys together. Okay. I mean, that's just, a lot of teams go through the flu. Sure. I mean, you listen to your science team and you go from there.
That is Canucks head coach Rick Tocchet addressing the media. They'll take on the Colorado Avalanche 7:30 tonight at Rogers Arena, wrapping up a 6-game homestand before they head out to take on Utah and Vegas. Back-to-back games on the road on Wednesday and Thursday. And, man, Tocchet, of course, asked about Nathan MacKinnon early in that clip, and as you would expect, right, one of the best players in the league, leading the league in points coming to town, and just the laser focus on the fact that Nathan MacKinnon is constantly moving his feet, right? And I mean, who have we heard that from Tocchet in relation to a lot, right? It's Elias Pettersson, and it's hard not to draw the line there between, hey, this guy who's their number one center, who's one of the studs in the league, look, different styles, of course, even when they're at their peak. We were talking about the power-speed combination from MacKinnon earlier with Landon. That's never going to be Elias Pettersson's game, but just that relentless, relentless focus from Tocchet on move your feet, skate, very, very striking.
No, and I mean, Pettersson's never going to skate angry, but do you remember how slippery? Like, Pettersson, the bro to your deeks, Apex Pettersson, is, like, incredibly slippery.
Yeah.
His skating stride has occasionally lacked power, but his edges, the way he attacks on the A-frame, like, there was some Kovalev in it, and there was some power in it, real power, and real deception. And I do think what we're seeing at the moment, and backed up by the NHL edge data, is a player who, I mean, even when he's succeeded and produced, which he's done on occasion throughout the season, I mean, it's not been Pettersson, Apex Pettersson, but there have been a lot of times where people have been like, yeah, he looks like he's back. I mean, he's on pace for, what, 75 points, 70 points? I mean, it's not like there's an absence of production or game-breaking moments or smart plays, but I do think there's a little bit less juice.
I would say there is a bit of an absence of game-breaking plays.
Yeah, but only because his standard is so high. I mean, this is literally a guy who had a 100-point season and turned a line with Mikheyev and Andrei Kuzmenko into one of the most imposing units in hockey. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, the peaks that we've seen Pettersson occasionally ascend are above the clouds, and right now I think we're seeing like a good player.
Yep.
And I think the reason for it, honestly, at the end of the day, there is a certain absence of juice, a certain absence of the deception, game breaking stuff that has separated him and made him elite for most of his career.
Yeah, and it the debate and the speculation about is it physical or is it mental is it's fascinating because, you know, you think back to him saying he had tendonitis after the playoffs, right? And in stark contrast to the rest of the team, even the very obviously injured ones saying, no. How could you possibly think there was anything wrong with me, right? And it's just baffling to me because, as you said, you look at the NHL Edge data and this and the skating speed and all of that, and it's so far down, and you would seem to think, okay, what's going on with his knee, right? Tendonitis, all of that. Is that preventing him from getting that jump, having that juice? But the team does not seem receptive to that idea, right? You know, if that doesn't match a coach then constantly hammering on, he's got to move his feet. It just seems like there's a disconnect there where I am open to the idea that, well, hey, what do you expect? He's playing hurt. He's playing through this. That would seem to explain a lot of things, but for whatever reason, that doesn't seem to be an explanation the team is interested in hearing. So I don't know. It's continues. This just in, the Elias Pettersson situation continues to be baffling and frustrating from a Canucks perspective. But that is the latest from Canucks head coach Rick Tocchet. And as somebody texted in, you got to listen to the science team, boys. You love the science team.
Also,
you never disregard what the science team is telling you.
I wish I had a science
team. Oh, can you imagine? Call up the science team?
What would you ask your science team for? First request, John.
From the science team.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good question.
I think mine would all be coffee-based.
Like how to nail your coffee?
Yeah, just like I'd show them the right acidity. I'd show them my coffee, my morning coffee routine, and I'd just be like, where can I make better coffee?
Because it's such an important blooming this for the right amount of time.
Yeah, because it's such an important part of my day. But I'm also like, you know.
But you need a science team.
I'm not like a fancy beans guy. I'm just a basic French press guy. But as they're like small little things, like even like how to optimally heat my water, how much time.
Mine might be like that, but around like food and like grilling.
Ooh,
the science of making meat delicious.
Mm.
The Maillard
effect. That's what I would want.
I'll be honest with you. I feel like I got that down.
Brag. All right. That does it for us. Enjoy the game tonight. We're back tomorrow for more Canucks talk here on Sportsnet 650.